But this is an enormous subject here this evening. The subject is the sacraments of vocation, marriage and holy orders. And please understand, this is the most brief possible look at these. I'm totally glossing over something for which I could have an entire class just on either one of these subjects. But let's have a basic understanding, okay? And it's all in your notes. But before we can do that, we need to talk about the meaning of the word vocation. Now, your notes have an error in them. Your notes, it says, a vocation is a job but a call. What I meant to say is a vocation is not a job, but a call. Most people think that a vocation is a job. Call 1-800-ITT-TECH to start your vocation as a computer repair specialist. Call now. Operators are standing by. They think it's a job. When I talk to the grade school students here in the school about vocations, and I'm talking about priesthood, maybe becoming a religious brother or sister, the vocation of matrimony, they'll shoot up their hands and they'll say, my vocation is to be an NBA star. My vocation is to be a hot rock singer. Everybody thinks it's a job. So let's clarify what a vocation is. In our understanding in the Catholic Church, it has a very specific meaning. It comes from the Latin word vocare, which means to call. Now, who's doing the calling? God is doing the calling. Who is God calling? He's calling you. You'd be amazed when I do marriages for people. I'll talk about vocation and I'll say, vocation is a call. Who's the call from? They'll say, from us? Are we calling God? No, God always initiates. The call is from God. The call is to you. What's the call about? Why get married? Why become a priest? Why become a nun, religious sister, brother? The answer is God is trying to call you to know him, to love him, and to serve him. The call is about God. The call is about coming to know who God is and falling head over heels madly in love with God. The process of doing that, which does lead to heaven, because it makes you into a saint, but the process of doing that is a process of overcoming your ego. So when two people get married, I know it's very sweet, very lovely, very romantic. But when it comes down to brass tacks, and you have to talk to these two people about what their life is really going to be like for the next 50 or 60 years, you have to level with them and tell them there's a heck of a lot of selfishness in you, and you've got to get over it, or you are not going to be happy. Do you understand that? There is no happiness until you overcome your ego, and that means it's going to hurt. And you have to learn to do what the other person wants and to set yourself aside and to say you're sorry and to all the other things that are involved in overcoming ego and self-will. And that's the vocation, ladies and gentlemen. That's the nature of the vocation, because every vocation is a call from God to you to become a saint. And nobody becomes a saint until they learn to overcome their self-will. Does that make sense? That's what it's all about. So very often you'll talk about vocations and you'll say, you know, priesthood's a vocation and marriage is a vocation. Everybody says, oh, I want to be married. I want to be married. Why don't you? Well, because priesthood, that's hard. And I'm like, until you realize marriage is hard, you're not ready. You're not ready for it, because every vocation asks you to overcome yourself. Okay. You know the funny thing about being a priest versus being married? When you're a priest and something goes wrong, you know who's at fault, because you know it's not God, right? I know it's me. But when you're married, you got to figure out, was it me? Was it her? Was it both of us? It's complicated, all right? So understand that about a vocation. A vocation is also about your role in God's plan for the world. So it's not just me overcoming my selfishness. It's also God working out a plan. So I'm supposed to be a priest, not just so that I can get to heaven, but presumably that I can help other people get to heaven too, and that's part of the plan. And people get married not just so they can get to heaven, but presumably they'll be a good mother, a good father, to guide their children, help raise them right, help them get to heaven too. It's always part of God's plan. That's a vocation, okay? So, everyone's called to God and everyone's called to heaven and everyone's called to avoid their ego, but not everybody has a sacrament for their vocation. When you become a religious nun, a sister, is it a sacrament? No, it is not. What if you never get married? Do you have a sacrament? No, you don't. So you can have a vocation without having a sacrament. Today, all we're talking about are the sacraments of vocation. Okay, so please don't misunderstand. And we're going to start by talking about matrimony. I used to talk about holy orders first, because that's what everyone's most interested in. But then I didn't have enough time for matrimony. So we're going to start with matrimony and get that kind of out of the way here. And again, I could go so deep into this, and I'm only just scratching the surface. But the best way to understand matrimony, believe it or not, is from a quote from the Code of Canon Law, which is the church's rule book. And the quote says this: "The marriage covenant, by which a man and woman establish between themselves a partnership for the whole of life, is by nature ordered towards the well-being of spouses, the procreation and education of children. Jesus Christ himself raised this covenant between baptized persons to the dignity of a sacrament." Now that's a loaded statement. Every word in there matters. Let's look at them, okay? Let's take a look at some of these words. First of all, a covenant. What's a covenant? A covenant differs from a contract. That's how we're going to understand it, okay? It's a covenant. We'll get to the fact that it's between a man and a woman in just a moment. But a contract is an agreement between persons whose terms are drawn up by persons. So to build this building, we had a contract. If you do this, create what I put on these, what the architect put on these blueprints, you deliver that, and in exchange, I will deliver this amount of money from a bank account. Deal? Deal. That's a contract. It's an exchange between persons whose terms are drawn up by persons. A covenant is not that. It's an agreement with God, and it's unilateral. You can't change a covenant. It's given on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. So this is very important to understand. We're saying that marriage is this from the very beginning. And we're living in a society, as you know, that thinks that it's a contract. We can change the terms, make it whatever we want it to be. And I'm saying, nope. Not only is that not Christian, that's not reality. But it's an agreement between us and God, whose terms are made by God. Now, here's probably the heart of it. A contract is an exchange of goods or services or payments. This is mine and that is yours. But a covenant is an exchange of persons. I am yours and you are mine. That's a covenant. So God said to Abraham, I will be your God and you will be my people. What's being given in a covenant? The whole self is being given away. And it's always on God's terms. Do you see where we're beginning to form the kind of the foundation of what we understand as Christians as matrimony here? You can't change it. You can't amend it. It's that serious that it involves the gift of your entire self given away. I am yours and you are mine. The terms of a contract can be amended or changed. The terms of a covenant can never be changed. So it's a covenant by which a man and a woman. Now, once upon a time, I didn't have to stop and explain this. To say that a marriage was between a man and a woman was like saying a circle is round. If I explained it, people would have laughed at me, and they would have said, what other completely obvious things are you going to waste our time talking about? But those days are over. These days, I have to explain a little bit about why it's between a man and a woman. I would say that no other combination is a marriage. Two men is not a marriage. Two women is not a marriage. Two men and a woman is not a marriage, or any other combination you can dream up is not a marriage. Why? Because male and female are complementary persons, and there's no changing them. We live in a world that thinks that you can switch from being male to female, same as you can transfer between colleges or switch jobs. But that's just not real. The fact of the matter is, not only is every last cell in your body coded with the DNA to be a man or a woman, not only are the skeletons different, I mean, you can tell after someone's been buried 1,000 years, if you can still see the skeleton, whether they were a man or a woman, right? The pelvic bone on a woman is different from the pelvic bone on a man. But that's not really the heart of it. The fact of the matter is, spiritually speaking, we are different. And that is why a woman will always be a mystery to a man. And he can live with her for 80 years and she's still a mystery. And vice versa. You know, a woman, she will never understand a man. And that's wonderful. They're infinite. They're two halves, two complementary parts of the divine image. In the divine image, he made them. Male and female, he created them. This is who you are physically. This is who you are spiritually. This is who you are emotionally. This is who you are psychologically. And the most amazing thing about it is they're complementary. The trouble with feminism is that it tries to have a woman do everything that a man can do. A woman isn't supposed to do everything that a man can do. A woman is supposed to do everything that a man cannot do. That's what makes her wonderful. You know, they can do all the wonderful things that a man can't do, and vice versa. It's a spiritual complementarity, and it forms an exclusive bond. You know, if a man and a woman are reasonably the same age and reasonably compatible, have you ever noticed they can't really be friends with each other without, like, falling in love? And that it kind of becomes exclusive. That's why you got to watch out. You know, you get married to somebody, and there's no guarantee you're not going to fall in love with somebody else. You got to watch yourself. It's very easy to fall in love. It's as easy as falling in love, they say, right? And that's because we're complementary. We complete one another. And it forms this exclusive bond, which is, by the way, the only reason why marriage stops at two. That's why you can't have three or four or anything else. That complementarity kind of bonds one with the other, and your body is not an accident. It's an expression of your identity. This is more of a social commentary now, but the idea that we're going to try to meld the two different sexes into some sort of homogeneous unity of gray is to deprive the world of something greatly good. What's really good is when women are women and when men are men. It's beautiful. In fact, in the Chinese language, I love languages, and I learn all the languages that I can. The word for good is made from the word for man right next to the word for woman. Isn't that cool? That's the word for good. So it's between a man and a woman, and it can't ever be anything else. And I don't care how unpopular it becomes. It's just nothing can be done about it. But it's a good thing. And here's another thing. It's established between themselves. Now understand this. This is one sacrament a priest doesn't celebrate. A priest merely witnesses it. Who are the witnesses to matrimony? The best man, the maid of honor, and the priest. The best man represents all the guys in the world. The maid of honor represents all the ladies in the world. And the priest represents God. God rarely makes public appearances, so the priest stands in his place. Okay? That's what the priest is doing there for the wedding. Is the priest literally marrying the two? He's not. He's hearing their vows. But they give this sacrament to each other by offering in their vows and by receiving the vows from the other. Okay? So it's established between themselves and not the priest celebrating this as a sacrament. Now, the priest celebrates Mass, the priest celebrates confession, the priest celebrates anointing of the sick. The priest does not celebrate matrimony. Only the couple does that. Okay? It's for life. That's the next part of our little definition. A partnership for the whole of life. As the church, we believe divorce is a legal proceeding. The state says you're divorced, God says you're not. Now, I'm not going to get into annulments this evening. It would be a whole other subject and a very lengthy one. But we think that divorce is an operation of the government. The church doesn't, for the church, it doesn't even exist. Don't even recognize it. What God has joined together, no one tears asunder. For life, for a twofold purpose, for the well-being of spouses and the procreation and education of children. Now, marriage is ordered towards sanctifying a soul. That's what we mean by we say the well-being of spouses. That line actually came into canon law about 600 years ago because there was a feud between two clans in Italy. And this actually happened. I don't remember the names of the two clans, but let's just make up two Italian names, and they're fighting with each other for centuries. And their chieftains get together, and one chieftain has a son, the other has a daughter, and the son decides to marry the daughter, and the clans are going to bury the hatchet. And it happened. And after that, he made her life a living hell. And it was his revenge against the other clan. Ever since then, the church said, for the well-being of spouses, you have to wish the other one well, okay? But really wishing the other one well is hoping that they get to heaven. And hoping you help them get to heaven, and they help you get to heaven, okay? That's what we mean by we say the well-being of spouses. And it's also for the procreation and education of children. Now notice this, I don't use the word reproduction. I use the word procreation. You know what the difference is? Reproduction is what happens when you use a Xerox machine. But procreation has a specific meaning. Because when a man and a woman become parents, they bring into existence something which has never existed before and will exist forever. Every time you see a child, remember that. That soul did not exist before. And now will exist for all of eternity. You know what they've just done? They've continued God's act of creation. That's why we call it procreation. God delegates to us. God made the heavens and the earth and all the animals and all the stars and all the galaxies and all the waters of the sea and the birds of the sky and all the things that God made. But then he said, I'm going to let you all continue my work because there's souls that are going to be brought into existence and it's going to happen with your cooperation. That's why we call it procreation, okay? So it's a very, very beautiful thing. And education. No one can replace the parents in educating their children in the ways of the faith. This is a problem I see in religious education programs. It's a problem I see in Catholic schools. They'll drop their kid off, put them in a class for an hour a week, and then pick their kid up in an hour and a half later, expect their kid was made Catholic, not realizing that they do 90% of the teaching of the Catholic faith and the school, the religious education program, does about 10% of the teaching. And if the parent doesn't teach, now there are exceptions. Some people can learn their faith in all sorts of ways, but the natural way is if it's learned, not learned at home, it's not learned at all. So parents, you have a responsibility of teaching your kids the faith. If you haven't lived that responsibility up today, start. Because I've got news for you. Every child delivered to a parent is a blank slate. And the parents have an extraordinary authority, God-given authority, to write lines on that blank slate, and they will answer to God for what they've done. So it's very, very important that parents teach the kids their faith. And by example, but above all else, as best they're able. In fact, sometimes when I hear first confessions of second graders, I'll get parents walking into the confessional. And I will look at them, and they will look at me, and I will tell some sort of lighthearted joke along the lines of, "You're the biggest second grader I've ever seen." In other words, what are you doing in confession? You're a grown-up. This is for second graders. And they'll say, "Father, I need to go to confession because I realize my kid is learning bad habits from me and I got to turn my own bad habits around." And I'll say, "Good for you. You recognize the truth. Your kids learn from you." So the procreation and the education of children. Now it's raised to the dignity of a sacrament. Question for you. How many sacraments are there? Seven. Who made them? Is one of the sacraments matrimony? Yes. Was there matrimony before Christ came along? Yes. Well, then how do we say the matrimony is a sacrament if matrimony existed before Christ? Answer, we believe that Christ did something to matrimony. We believe he changed it. He raised it to a dignity that it never had before. In previous generations and centuries, and I could get into this in greater detail, it was a merely natural good. But he raised it to a supernatural good, an image of himself and his church, which means three things. I got this a little bit out of order here in your notes. The union between the husband and wife is an image of the union between Christ and the church. St. Paul told us this in Ephesians. That means it's faithful, permanent, and life-giving. It's faithful. And if they don't want to be faithful, they're not married. They can't be married without the willingness to be faithful. But matrimony gives them the grace they need to be faithful to each other and to give themselves away as a gift. It's permanent. Once a sacramental marriage is entered into and ratified, which we'll talk about in a second, it cannot be dissolved except by death. And it's life-giving. It's ordered towards the procreation and the education of children. The supreme gift of marriage is children. That's very countercultural thinking. People these days think of the supreme gift of marriage is romantic love. No, it's not. That's a means to an end. There's nothing at all greater than a child that was brought into existence. That's the greatest gift of all. And if two people otherwise marriage age and otherwise healthy and otherwise perfectly healthy and well, you know, not lacking or anything like that, if they don't want to have kids, I can't marry them. It's happened once and once only. Two people came to the priest, namely me, and they wanted to be married. And we talked about, well, do you want to be faithful to each other forever? Yes. Do you enter into this for life? Yes. Do you want to have kids? Absolutely not. Wait a minute. You're 24. She's 23. You don't want to have kids? Nope. Never? Never. Why not? Because I want to get a great, as a quote, because I want to buy a great car. Couldn't do anything with them. Couldn't do anything for them. They could tell me they want to have kids in a year. They could tell me they want to have kids in 2 years, but I can't help them if they don't want to have kids at all. That's not the plan. Again, this is a covenant. We can't change the terms. Okay? But that's what we mean when we say we raise it to a dignity of a sacrament. It was an image of Christ and his church, who is faithful, permanent, and life-giving. Now, here's a bit of trivia for you. It's only a sacrament when both people are baptized. Do you know that? If even one of the two is not baptized, it's not a sacrament. Because who gives the sacrament to each other? The couple does. What's the first sacrament they receive? Baptism. So if you have a Catholic marrying a Jew, at the higher altar of St. Peter's, and the Pope himself witnesses it, it's not a sacrament. Why? Because they're not both baptized. If you marry someone unbaptized and you become baptized, the moment you both become baptized, your marriage instantly becomes a sacrament. Instantly. Okay? But it does assume you're baptized first. I can't say that Jesus raised this to the dignity of a sacrament without also starting with baptism. Now, here's something you might find interesting. We've talked about form and matter before with regard to sacraments, right? So, for example, with regard to Eucharist, the matter or the material of the Eucharist is the host, right? Or the wine. And the form, or in other words, the words are, this is my body, this is my blood. With regard to anointing of the sick, the matter or the material is the oil. And the form is, well, I won't go through it all, this priest says a prayer. But what really throws people for a loop with matrimony is the form and the matter. Because the words, otherwise the form, is the vows, you and you alone for the rest of my life. But this is what really throws people for a loop. The matter is sexual intercourse. That's what makes it a sacrament. No joke. You want to know why? Because sexual intercourse has a meaning that can't be changed. And the meaning is, you and you alone for the rest of my life. And I don't care how bad the culture botches this, that meaning remains the same. I ask you to think about something. Think about the fact that people who are promiscuous are kind of frowned upon. I'm going to draw back a historical example that many of you might be too young to remember. But the example is Bill Clinton. Everybody knows Bill Clinton was kind of a wild guy. Lots of ladies on the side. And everybody knew it. And everybody kind of made disparaging jokes at his expense. If you lived through it, you know. If you didn't live through it, call up YouTube and you can watch the late night comedians. But they weren't just lighthearted jokes. They were disparaging jokes. They were at his expense. They were jokes made to the public, all of whom seemed to agree that this really isn't good. People shouldn't be like this. This is wrong. And it was commonly understood. And even in a society that has no understanding of sexual morality. And the reason why I say that is because at some level, we know that that action has an intrinsic meaning. And that meaning is, I can't share this with anybody else, ever. This is just you. What I mean to say is, that's marriage vows. And that's the foundation of sexual morality in the church. People think the church thinks sex is dirty. The fact of the matter was, we think sex is sacred. We think it's marriage vows. We think it's ultimately saying, this means I am yours forever, and I'll never give this to anybody else. That's the foundation of what it means. Does that make sense? Okay. But that's the form and the matter. So once this sacrament is vowed and then ratified, it's a sacrament. Okay? And I hope that helps. It's a public state. These days, everybody just sleeps together before they're married. But it's still wrong. In an idealized society, it's a way of saying, these two people who are now living together, they vowed their lives together before God. It's holy. So it's a public state. What's fascinating is that no matter where you go, you'll always find that matrimony has been regarded as sacred and public. This is fascinating. But like, if you could follow pioneers across the Old West as they blazed a trail to the Pacific and they ran into native tribe after native tribe, right? They found the Sioux and the Arapaho and the Cheyenne, and the Crow, and the Nez Perce, until they finally went cross-country, right? Tribe after tribe after tribe all thought marriage was something sacred. It was something that was like done before the gods. If you go to pre-Columbian Mesoamerica, you know, go to the ancient Aztecs and Toltecs, same thing. Get on a boat and sail to prehistoric, I don't know, China or Japan. Everybody was never private and it was always sacred. Isn't that fascinating that people instinctively know that? Okay. Now, a couple of nuts and bolts here for you about marriage. The free and unconditional exchange of consent makes the marriage. If it's conditional, it's not a marriage. It's invalid. So if Mr. marries Mrs. and Mrs. says, I'll stick with you only if you get a better job. That's a condition. That's not valid. If Mr. marries Mrs. and she says, I'll stick with you, but you got to drop some pounds. That's conditional. That's not a marriage. It has to be taken the way Christ takes us, unconditionally, okay? And freely. So you've heard of a shotgun wedding, right? From the hills of Kentucky. Maybe a guy got in trouble with a girl. Dad breaks out a shotgun, cocks the shotgun, puts it in his back, says, you're marrying my daughter now. Can anyone be forced to marry somebody else? The moment you force it, it's not a marriage. It has to be free, or it's not even valid. Never even happened, okay? Now, in the church, it has to be done between a bride and groom and a minister of the church, which is why if you're a Catholic and you got married by somebody who wasn't a bishop, priest, or deacon, you haven't gotten married yet. That's a basic, and it's missing. It always has to be public, but that's usually not a problem. I don't know any two people that get married with no witnesses at all. But you need two witnesses, and if you're a Catholic, you get to be married by a minister of the church. What if you're not a Catholic? What if you're Protestant? Do you have to have a bishop, priest, or deacon there? You do not. If you're Protestant, you can get married any ways you want because your consent makes the marriage. But if you're Catholic, you've got to have a minister of the church there. Now, real briefly, some invalidating factors of marriage. I'm only going to race through these. Lack of form, which means it wasn't in front of a priest. Coercion, shotgun wedding. Psychological or mental incapacity, people who don't even understand what they're going into. As I mentioned before, refusal to have children. Or you're unwilling to be faithful. I heard anecdotally, actually I won't name the name of the politician who was involved, just for the sake of protecting the innocent. But a conversation that took place before this politician got married, and he was talking to his brother and his father. He says, well, does this mean I can't screw around on the side anymore? And the brother and the father said, oh, come on, everybody does that. Of course you can. So there was no intention to be faithful. That's invalidating. That prevents the marriage from even happening. Age is a factor. If you've been married before, it's a factor. If you're too closely related by blood, that's a factor. Okay, all those things can make a marriage invalid. Effects of matrimony. Perfects your charity. It's the only sacrament that's a source of grace for your day-by-day living. My priesthood doesn't do that for me. My priesthood exists for your well-being, but not for mine. I still have to work that out the same way as anyone else works theirs out. But matrimony helps you day by day. Strengthens their unity. Helps them become spiritually, physically, psychologically one. Helps them grow in holiness. And gives them the grace they need to raise all those loud kids. Okay, so that's matrimony, and that is a nutshell. That is really brief. Let's go over holy orders while we still have some time. This one's more interesting to people. But I talked to you about how God delegates his authority to create to men and women in matrimony. In a same sense, God delegates his own teaching, his own authority, and his own ability to give his grace, his life. He delegates this to bishops and priests, and that's holy orders. What's holy orders? Well, it comes from the word ordo, which means a group or a body. So don't think of holy orders as being like, you know, like a general giving out orders to troops. Holy orders means like this is a grouping of people set apart, set aside, by which Christ himself continues to teach and to hand on his grace until the end of time. So let's talk about what a priest is, because this will help us understand bishops and priests. A priest is a mediator. He's a go-between. Somebody who goes between God and man, who brings about a union between God and man by means of sacrifice. That's what a priest is. There are lots of priests in the Old Testament, believe it or not. People always think of priests as being Catholic priests. But the first priest was someone named Melchizedek. And if you've been to Mass and you've heard me say Mass, at least, I always use that prayer, your high priest Melchizedek. He shows up in the book of Genesis. He's called a priest of God Most High. And he offered a sacrifice of bread and wine to God before just disappearing. And he's the first one named as a priest in the Bible. But in the Old Testament, priesthood was dependent on, was established by Moses. If you go back to the Old Testament and you read the stories of Moses in the book of the Exodus, you might remember the story of Moses in the Exodus and let my people go. And what you'll discover is that God spoke to Moses and then Moses turned and spoke to the people. And then the people would speak to Moses and he would take their petitions to God. He was a go-between. He was a mediator. That is what a priest is. Okay? That is what a priest is. He's a mediator. He's a go-between. And he establishes peace between God and us by means of sacrifice. Just as a source of interest, priests still exist in Judaism. Everyone thinks that priesthood is Catholic. But in Judaism, priesthood is genetic. You're born a priest because you are a descendant of Moses. And anyone who's named Khan or Cohen or Khan, a Hebrew word which literally means priest, is a descendant of Moses. In fact, there was a genetic study by which a bunch of people with the last name Cohen were found to have one common ancestor. Isn't that cool? Descendants of Moses, even from back then. And Old Testament priests offered prayer and sacrifice in the Temple of Jerusalem, taught and preached, kept alive the memory of God's saving activities in history. But let's face it, who was the one person par excellence who brought about a union between God and man by means of sacrifice? That one had to be Jesus Christ, correct? Jesus Christ is the go-between. He's the mediator. He's the priest. You ever heard of Jesus Christ called a priest before? There's a whole book of the Bible dedicated to it, the letter to the Hebrews. The whole thing is about how Christ is a priest. He's the one that brings a union between God and man by means of sacrifice, his own sacrifice on the cross. So far, so good. Now you're equipped to understand what Holy Orders is. Holy Orders is a delegation of Christ's own priesthood to frail human beings. That's what it is. So as a bit of trivia, sometimes I'll get up there and I'll preach on this. I've done this on Holy Thursday, in which there's usually like 7, 8, 9 priests up there on the altar, and they're all concelebrating the Holy Thursday Mass in Holy Week. And I'm up there giving the homily. And I'll turn and I'll say, how many priests are there in the world? And I'll say, if you look up here at the sanctuary, you think you got enough priests to start your own church. But the fact of the matter is, there's only one priest. If I'm a priest, the only reason I'm a priest is because I'm sharing in Jesus' own priesthood. That's why I'm a priest. Why is the Pope a priest? Because he's sharing in Jesus' own priesthood. Remember all that stuff I told you about ex opere operato, and it doesn't matter who the priest is, the sacrament's always the same? That's why. Make sense? Okay. That's what we mean. Holy Orders is a sacramental union with the person of Christ so deep that the priest actually acts in his name himself. Notice when the priest is up there saying Mass, he does not say, this is Jesus' body given up for you. This is Jesus' blood given up for you. Jesus forgives you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. What does he say? I absolve you. Now, if you hear that with the ears of faith, you realize that Jesus is the one saying the I in that moment. That's what's going on in the Catholic priesthood, okay? So that you understand. And I hope that's nice and clear. But what we say is that the apostles were given this by Christ. They were given the power and the authority to preach, to govern, to sanctify, to shepherd the church, and they passed it on. They passed it on through the imposition of hands and the prayer of the church. And that's the sacrament that takes place at ordination. When a priest is ordained, he's given the power to act in the very person of Christ. He's not elected. If you go to a Protestant church, you'll find that they elect their ministers. And if they don't like their minister, they give them a vote of no confidence. You ever heard that before? Now, in the Catholic Church, we don't do that. In the Catholic Church, you'll get some priest, like me, assigned by a bishop to a parish. And when I show up, everybody accepts me as their priest, and nobody voted for me. Nobody even knows my name. Why is that? The reason is because they trust the church that sent me. And they believe, as Catholics, that the sending ultimately comes from Christ himself, who sent his apostles out to preach in his name. Okay? So that's what happens. But a lot of Catholics, by the way, they might really like the idea of a vote of no confidence. They wish they could take a vote on their priest or a vote on their bishop. And we don't like that guy anymore. Send me a new one. Give me a replacement. Can't do that. The sacrament takes place by a special prayer and the laying of hands on his head. And after that, he has a sacred power that he exercises in the name of Christ himself. It's not merely a function. Nobody else in the church can do this. If you didn't have a priest, you couldn't have Mass. If you didn't have a priest, you couldn't have confession. If you didn't have a priest, you couldn't have anointing of the sick. Because we say something happened to that guy when he got ordained. His life was conformed to the person of Christ. Okay? Now, it's one sacrament, but it has three different expressions. Bishop, priest, and deacon. There's all holy orders. A bishop is the fullness of the priesthood. A priest is a co-worker with a bishop. A deacon is something different. He's a servant. He acts in a role of service to the bishop and the priest, but the deacon himself is not a priest. Real briefly, each one of these three identities. A bishop has the fullness of the priesthood. We say that he is a successor to the apostles in an unbroken line. A priest, by contrast, is not a successor to the apostles. So Jesus commanded the apostles to go out and preach. Would you be surprised to learn that I can only preach if the bishop tells me that I can preach? It's true. It's called faculties. The bishop literally sends me a letter that says, these are your faculties. You can do this, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. And if the bishop were to write me a letter and say, you no longer have faculties to preach, and this happened once in our diocese, there's one priest who got up and every single week he talked about politics. Every single week he talked about the latest events from MSNBC. And the priest and the bishops, if you don't stop it, I'm going to take away your faculty to preach. And he did. And the guy couldn't give homilies anymore. I'm not a priest like a lone ranger. I'm a co-worker with the order of bishops. And as long as I'm in good graces with him, I can celebrate all these sacraments, even confirmation with the bishop's permission, which is what I'll do for all of you on the Easter Vigil. Okay? But the bishop has the fullness of the priesthood. Some people wonder, what about a cardinal? A cardinal is just a bishop who's been specially designated, delegated to... Sorry, I'm not good with distractions. I'm going to wait until whatever it is they're dragging is dragged by. A cardinal is just a bishop who's just been made a papal advisor and by a rule of the church is the one who elects the next pope. But he's just a bishop, okay? But let's talk about a deacon really briefly. A deacon is just a servant. They serve at the altar. They help distribute the Eucharist. They can witness marriages. But what's interesting about a deacon is they can't do anything that a layperson can't do. Any layperson can witness a marriage too, or distribute the Eucharist. They're given faculties to preach, sometimes to preside over certain parts of a funeral rite. Okay, but the sacrament of holy orders also gives a permanent character on the soul. You're changed forever as a consequence of having received holy orders. You can never be unordained. And in the case of an emergency, anyone who was a priest, and maybe they left the priesthood, maybe they should have left the priesthood. In the case of an emergency, they can still hear a confession, they can still say a Mass. They're not supposed to, but they can never be unordained. Okay? Now, there's a couple things I got here at the very tail end of your notes here that are just worth mentioning, and there are a couple of big controversies with regard to the priesthood, and they are celibacy and women priests. And it's only fair that I go over this somewhat briefly. So to stave off misunderstandings, first let's talk about celibacy. Commonly thinking, people think that celibacy is this antiquated discipline of the church by which priests aren't allowed to get married. And it's left over from the Middle Ages when the Pope tried to control everybody and you know, the church is really slow to change, so it's still hanging around. And that is 100% the stuff that comes out the back end of a horse, okay? So I hope you don't believe it. Celibacy you might be surprised to learn, was established by Christ himself. And I've given you the two passages here in the scripture that establish this, Matthew 19 and 1 Corinthians 7. What we're saying is that some people are given a charism or a gift by which they don't really need to have a spouse. They can get through life just fine without one. And the fact that they don't have a spouse makes it easier for them to cling to Christ with an undivided heart. And that is what celibacy is all about. What is celibacy all about? Clinging to God more easily. So let me ask you a question. Does it make sense that you can see it as something that would allow you to cling to God more easily? If it doesn't, let me tell you a couple of stories. Very often a priest will know some of the most devout women in the parish, right? The ones who, they go to daily mass, maybe they homeschool their children, maybe they go to help out in this, that, or the other committee, and they go to adoration of the Blessed Sacrament, and they're very, very devout, very prayerful. And almost without exception, at some point in their lives, they'll turn to me and they'll say, oh, I wish I could have more time to pray, and I wish I could have more time to go to mass, and I wish I could have more time to go to confession, and I wish I could do more spiritual reading, and I wish, but I got all these kids, and I got all these responsibilities, and I can't. And it's true. They got all those kids, and they got all the responsibilities, and they can't. But Christ himself, by a gift, has given some people the ability that they don't really need to be married. They can be okay without it. And celibacy is about drawing closer to the Lord. That's what it's about. Now, what we say as a church is that the church calls its priests from among those who already have that charism. People say, well, the church won't let priests get married. That's not accurate. What we're saying is, if you don't actually already have the charism, you probably shouldn't have become a priest in the first place. But we're saying the church calls its priests from among those who already have that charism. So it's not like an admission ticket to holy orders or that the church forbids marriage. And it's all ordered towards the deepest possible immersion in God. It's why Jesus said what he said. Some freely renounce marriage for the kingdom of God. Let him accept this who can. Not everyone can, but those who can ought to. It's also got an incredibly ancient tradition, which I draw out here in your notes. It goes back as in writings, at least, as early as writings were allowed to be maintained. Remember, before the year 306, the church was living under persecution and Christian writings were regularly burned. So celibacy, not what most people think it is. Most people think that it's this rule and, well, the priest doesn't have a wife so that he can have more hospital calls. You know, I had two hospital calls today, and it's true, it does free me up to do things like that. But if the idea was just to free me up to do more work and that I was otherwise supposed to get married, but I'm not going to have a wife or kids just so that I can do more work, that would be cruel. That's not what it's all about. Now, the last one is women priests. Popularly thinking, people think the church won't ordain women as priests because, you know, they're stuck in the Middle Ages and it's an old boys network and they're slow to change, but they'll eventually change with the times. And I want to tell you, that also comes out the back end of a horse, okay? We do not say that we will not ordain women. What we say is that we cannot ordain women. We believe we do not have the authority to do it. Only Christ has that authority, and he didn't do it. We're not the masters of the sacraments. Remember when I talked about that? Christ didn't do it, and we can't do it either. Just like I can't change matrimony, just like I can't change the Eucharist. I can't make it something other than bread and wine. I don't have the authority. People say, well, you know, Jesus, you know, he was just bound by the times, bound by the culture. Wrong. If anyone was not bound by the culture, it was Jesus himself. Everything he did as God, and he bucked trends all over the place. The Samaritans, the tax collectors, embracing a leper, making a tax collector and a prostitute his closest followers. He couldn't care less with the society. He wasn't bound by societal norms. So it's just not accurate to say that. I think one of the most important things to say that is if the church can ordain women, it must ordain women. Today, yesterday, if possible, because it's like saying I won't give you communion. It's like saying I won't give you baptism. It's like saying I won't let you be married. Goodness sakes, if it comes from God, who is man to stand in the way? The fact that we don't, I hope that gives thinking people at least some indication of the fact that it means that we don't think we can. Okay? Another thing to consider is that as history progressed, The odds were so heavily stacked in favor of women priests that it should have happened many, many times over, but it never happened. Church met culture after culture after pagan culture, all of whom had priestesses, but it never joined the ranks of those who had priestesses. When it went to Egypt, priestesses were essential to the divine services. When it went to the Greek world, priestesses were widely established and welcome. When it went to Northern Europe, Visigoth chieftains were considered to be warrior priestesses. Everywhere the church spread, they found women operating in the nature of priests, and still the church never ordained women. Believe it or not, it's actually a settled issue. It's not even up for debate. John Paul II declared this to be final and binding. Okay? When Christ ordained only men as his apostles, he acted in a free and sovereign manner. But I think maybe one of the most interesting things to consider here is that it's actually not even a theological question. It's a sociological one. When people want to talk about women priests, they don't say, well, you know, the scriptures say this, and our ancient Christian tradition is that, and our ancient Christian writings say this, the same way that they would talk about anything else in the church. They say, rather, you know, it's not fair, and it's an anachronism, and it's based on outdated sexual politics. It should have been changed. A sociological argument, not a theological one. What's interesting is, sociologically speaking, the Catholic faithful don't want women priests. Now, I've lived in Africa, and I've lived in Central America. With the exception of Western Europe, North America, New Zealand, and Australia, there's no call for women's ordination. It's just non-existent. In fact, it's greatly opposed. When I was living down in Mexico, I talked to some of the ladies about it, and they were like, es una tontería. It's an absurdity, right? If you speak Spanish, you know what I said. So I've got personal firsthand experience in this. The vast majority of the church, and understand, the church in the West is dying on the vine, but it's thriving in Latin America and it is booming in Africa. Sociologically speaking, if a few nations in Western Europe and North America decided they wanted to impose this, the vast majority of the church would be pretty upset about it. So sociologically speaking, it doesn't have much ground to stand on either. There's a number of different references that I could have mentioned, but I threw in a few of them there at the end of your notes. So those are just a couple of things just to kind of help you to grapple with some of the countercultural natures, kind of countercultural questions that you'll encounter in discussing the subject of matrimony. I'm sorry, the subject of holy orders with others. But it's an enormous subject. I wish I could talk about this much, much longer than I did, but I would say that's good enough for one day.